Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. For just the third time in the history of this republic, the Senate is set to hear the impeachment case against an American president. Chief Justice of the United States John Roberts administered the oath to Senator jurors.
Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God?
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he'll consider the case of the House, but isn't inclined to invite in witnesses. Yet new evidence and allegations keep surfacing. An indicted associate of Trump's personal attorney, Lev Parnas, says he was waist-deep in the Ukraine scheme and that the president's motivation was his personal, political gain.
It was strictly for him. But again, I thought he was our leader. He's the chief. He's the president. And it was all about 2020 to make sure he had another 4 years.
And the thermostat was turned way up this week in the Democratic presidential primary. A hot mic after a debate captured the tension between Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren over whether Sanders had privately told her a woman couldn't win the election.
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion, we'll have that discussion. You called me a liar. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
I don't want to get mailed. I just want to say hi, Bernie.
Yeah, good.
Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., Kimberly Atkins. She's WBUR's senior news correspondent. Kimberly, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, David.
Also here with us from Washington, Darlene Supervoll. She covers the White House for the Associated Press. Darlene, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Kim, and Darlene.
Well, guys, it strikes me today that what we're seeing is kind of two things running in parallel, right? You're having the solemnity and the ceremony of the moment, as sobering as it is when you take a step back, as we heard from the Chief Justice. And we're also having a lot of things unfold in public, not inside the august chambers and corridors of the Capitol building, but in Washington and our TV screens and everywhere around us that affect what it is the senators will be considering in the weeks to come. First, I guess let's take the ceremony of it. Let's talk a little, or let our listeners hear a little bit about what some of our leaders were saying. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke Wednesday at the ceremony where the House's articles of impeachment were signed before being transmitted to the Senate.
So sad, so tragic for our country that the actions taken by the president to undermine our national security, to violate his oath of office, and to jeopardize the security of our elections, the integrity of our elections, has taken us to this place. So today, we will make history.
Now, earlier in the day, Pelosi had named impeachment managers as her senior House members who will present the case to the Senate. She said then that chances of additional witnesses and documents in the trial are improved because she withheld the articles of impeachment as new information surfaced. Darlene Supervoll, help our sketch out for our listeners here, before we get to some of the new revelations of the last couple of days, what the rules of the road are as we understand them in the Senate, and how are the folks you cover in the White House accommodating, adjusting, strategizing for that?
Well, the big thing to know about what's happening in the Senate is yesterday we saw on TV Chief Justice John Roberts was walked over to the Senate chamber. He took his oath of office. He's going to be presiding over the impeachment trial. He then administered the same oath to senators where they swore to do impartial justice as they sit in the coming weeks listening to evidence in the trial. And then they all had to sign what's called the oath book. And in groups of four, in alphabetical order, they walked up to the well of the Senate, and you could watch them on TV, sign their names in the oath book. There are some procedural things that have to take place in the next couple of days, briefs both sides have to file briefs. But the big action will come on Tuesday, which is when the Senate trial will open in earnest at 1 p.m. on Tuesday afternoon.
Kimberly, you're a lawyer as well as an experienced reporter. As you've been reporting on this and as you've been watching this play out, Darlene just mentioned the oath book that is signed, and it's not to join Cub Scouts or Girl Scouts, right? It's a constitutional swearing that you're going to do this duty. Before we even get to the question of some of the things that we've talking about this week and some of the political implications that will affect a number of the senators, no doubt on both sides, it does seem to me as though these jurors who have sworn to look at these things with open minds have at least a clear majority of them have made clear exactly how they're going to vote, have made clear exactly how they feel about the case of the House. How do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, I don't think it's as difficult to reconcile as it may seem. I think we've heard a lot of people compare the impeachment trial process to a judicial trial process. And, you know, when people think about that, when they think about when they're called to be jurors, that they have to be impartial. If there is any kind of conflict, they probably won't even be seated on a jury, right? Well, an impeachment is not a trial in that sense. It's not a judicial trial. It's a political exercise. It was designed as such by the framers. And so I don't think there was a thought that these 100 senators will come in as if their minds had been erased of everything that had happened in the past. And if they leave their views at the door, they're elected officials. So I think some sort of idea about how they might vote is not disqualifying here. I think due impartial justice means listen to the evidence that is presented, seek evidence, making motions if you want to hear witnesses or get additional documents. And then based on that, based on what's before you, if you are convinced that this rises to a crime and misdemeanor that warrants being removed from office, vote as such.
Jack Beatty, one of the points that you've heard from the president's defenders is that there's no law that was broken here, no crime committed. And though, as Kimberly suggested, the kinds of high crimes and misdemeanors don't require actual crimes and it's not specified as such, that has been a talking point. As one of our listeners points out, Jacob Evans points out online, the GAO just rendered an opinion that the president did break the law, the OMB did break the law in withholding hundreds of thousands of dollars in military aid, defensive military aid to the Ukrainian, seemingly on the basis of asking for a favor of return, the announcement of an investigation of former Vice President Joe Biden. The GAO is the Government Accountability Office, and that's sort of an independent agency within the legislative branch of government. But it did found a law was broken, although that doesn't constitute an indictment or a conviction. Does that change in any way the tenor of debate or our understanding of some of the issues in front of us?
Well, I think it puts pressure on Republican senators who are susceptible to it. There are a handful of them who are in tight re-election contests, and they have to at least maintain the appearance of entertaining the possibility of witnesses, of being open to new evidence such as this. On the other hand, there, Cory Gardner this week, he was asked, well, is it wrong for a president to, ask a foreign government to help him in an election, to give dirt on his opponent for an election? And he just was the umpteenth Republican senator who simply wouldn't join with the question, wouldn't answer it. And there's pressure on them. But on the other side, you get Kevin McCarthy, when he was the House Minority Leader, when he was told about the GAO report, he said, he dismissed it in a phrase. He said, that's nothing. That's just mere piffle. Regulations, blah, blah, doesn't seem to bother him. But then again, he's from a safe district and no danger. So there'll be different responses to this new evidence, but it will put Republican senators under both intellectual and moral pressure.
Cory Gardner, obviously a Republican senator from Colorado, up for re-election. A fair point there. I want to play a clip of the president. He was asked in the Oval Office yesterday about reports that his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, wrote a letter for Ukraine Prime Minister Zelensky on behalf of Trump, requesting a meeting before his inauguration. President Trump denied he knew about the letter, but defended Giuliani.
It was very important to Rudy that I be a great president, and that's okay with me. It was very important to a lot of people, because our country was going to hell, and now our country's on a path that we haven't seen in decades and decades. We've never done better.
Zelensky, forgive me, the president of Ukraine. Darlene Superville, how confident, how concerned is the White House at this point as it enters this trial phase of the impeachment crisis?
Well, if the White House is concerned at all, they aren't showing it. You hear those close to the president basically dismissing some of the new revelations that have come out. We mentioned Lev Parnas and all the information that he's been talking about in TV interviews over the past couple of days, the existence of a letter that Giuliani wrote to the president of Ukraine. You heard the president there saying that he knew nothing about it. He also says that he doesn't know Lev Parnas, even though there are multiple photographs with the two of them in the same frame. And this is from the top down. You hear this from the president. You hear the same thing from the White House press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, and others who work in the press office, Kellyanne Conway. They insist the president did nothing wrong, and that he doesn't deserve to be impeached. He did not deserve to be impeached, and therefore he should not be removed from office.
It was interesting. You mentioned Kellyanne Conway sort of tap dancing around her knowledge and other members of the administration's knowledge of Lev Parnas. You referred to Parnas. He is, of course, the associate of Rudy Giuliani, who has come out this week saying he's been active in Ukraine on the president's behalf. We're going to be talking about him after a short break. We'll be talking about the impeachment proceedings against President Trump, what it'll mean for the president, what it'll mean for senators on both parties. We want our guests to stick around, and we want you folks to stick around. We'll be taking calls right after the short break, and we'll then be hearing a little bit more about the developments of the week. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the U.S. Senate impeachment trial against President Trump, the legal and political perils for the president, also for his jurors, which is to say the members of the U.S. Senate. Plus, we'll be talking about the latest details we're learning from an associate of his personal attorney about events in Ukraine. And a bit later on, we'll talk about phase one of the new trade deal with China and what it might mean for you. Follow us on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a superstar and super sharp panel of guests with me this hour. Darlene Superville from the Associated Press, Kimberly Atkins from WBUR's in Washington, and our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. We've got a number of calls now. I want to take a couple of them. Let's start with a call from Jim in Newtown, Connecticut. Weigh in here. What do you think about what you're seeing there?
Well, very briefly, I am greatly encouraged to see the impeachment process start to unfold, the majesty of the process, if you will, and the seeming seriousness with which some of these senators, at least, are going to take this. These are high crimes used with our tax money, which is really what irritates me the most, that our tax money was used as a cudgel apparently for the president's personal gain. And I invite, I wonder if your guests would have anything to say about the possibility that Supreme Court Justice Roberts being there, to what extent could the Senate choose to make him more and more the arbiter, as he has the most objective viewpoint, and could by simply a majority vote be given the power to set the procedural rules. And I think that would be a welcome thing. And I think that the cult of Trumpism, the sway of this cult is, we will now see it disintegrate in the course of this impeachment. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling in, Jim. We'll talk a little bit about Lev Parnas in a couple of minutes, an associate of the president's personal attorney who used the same phrase, a cult-like aura or a culture around the president. But Kim Atkins, be my lawyer for a moment. You know, talk to me about the Chief Justice, the role he could play. It has been pointed out that were the Senate to essentially decide to give him the authority, he could have the rules, or that he could break in certain moments Senate ties if there was a tangle-up over how to proceed. Particularly, I think people are thinking in light of, would there be witnesses? Could there be more evidence? That sort of question coming along.
Yeah, well, the Chief Justice, don't expect him to jump in and act as some sort of, you know, hero, depending on what side you're pulling for in the impeachment. He is somebody who is known to really stick to process. He does not like to himself be politicized. He's very careful when it comes to the image of the Supreme Court, and I'm sure he will be just as careful when it comes to this proceeding as not being seen to be putting his thumb on the scale as the senators decide what to do. It will be up to him to rule on motions, including a motion to ask for particular witnesses or documents to be presented. And yes, he could be the tiebreaker if there is a 50-50 tie on a motion. I think the chances of that are so small that I don't expect that to happen. But if he rules on a motion for something, for example, for a witness, the Senate also has the ability to overrule his decision by a simple majority vote. So I don't think this is the case. I think the chances are very low that the senators all say, you know what, we'll just listen to what the Chief Justice says. They all clearly, as they've telegraphed, have their own views about things like witnesses, and they're split on party lines, with the exception of a handful of senators who may allow some witnesses at some point in the trial, and maybe not. But I don't think that the Chief Justice will be given free rein in this.
News breaking today, even as we speak, that it's clear that the president is thinking hard about who he wants to represent him. He has added Ken Starr, famously the independent counsel in the Clinton impeachment process. Robert Ray, another impeachment counsel that kind of closed out the Whitewater investigation. And Alan Dershowitz, the emeritus Harvard law professor who's shown up repeatedly as a defender of the president and his authority as the commander-in-chief. That he's adding them as sort of his representatives as his legal team for the Senate trial, notably, or not incidentally, all common figures on the Fox News channel, one of the president's main conduits of information. Jack Beatty, I wanted to play a clip from Lev Parnas. He's sort of dominated the airwaves for the last 48 hours or so. He's an associate of President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. He also, it's important to note, is under federal indictment for his involvement in efforts to pressure the president of Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. And that's the same pressure that led to President Trump's impeachment, or helped to lead to it. Parnas is now speaking out about his motivations. He implicated the president directly in all of the plans he executed. Here he spoke with CNN's Anderson Cooper.
It was strictly for him. But again, I thought he was our leader. He's the chief. He's the president. And it was all about 2020 to make sure he had another 4 years. And I didn't.
But that's how you personally viewed it, that this is about 2020 to help him get the next 4 years.
That was the way everybody viewed it. I mean, that was the most important thing, is for him to stay on for another 4 years and keep the fight going. I mean, there was no other reason for doing it.
Jack Beatty, some of the things that Parnas said were backed up. He provided a lot of texts between himself and various actors in this drama, including Giuliani. He produced that letter that Giuliani wrote to the president of Ukraine, basically introducing himself as the president's personal lawyer who needed some of the Ukrainian president's time. And there's some things he didn't substantiate, as far as I can tell. What did you make of the allegations, the charges, and the information that he put into public view in recent days?
Well, it can't surprise anybody who's been following who followed the testimony in the House hearings. It essentially echoes and brings closer to the president the charge, the allegations there made by witness after witness, that there was what the transcript, as the president said, reveals, a pressure campaign on Ukraine to help to come out with dirt on Biden. And interestingly, one of the documents on Ritz-Carlton stationery, I guess in Vienna, it shows Parnas writing that pressure Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, to announce an investigation of Hunter Biden, not to investigate Hunter Biden. That's corruption. You want to look into whether there's been corruption. To announce an investigation. That's what the president wanted. Simply the appearance of looking into Biden, which would allow the president to demagogue that issue to death. So he does have, as you say, some objective support for some of his contentions. Others, such as, you know, the Attorney General Barr was in the loop. He knew everything that was going on and so on. Well, that awaits, I think, some kind of proof. He made allegations about Mike Pence as well. And Republicans rightly are saying, wait a minute, this man is an indicted, he's under indictment. You can't take what he says. And he has motives for saying what he says. And so you can't take any of this on face value and need to be very skeptical.
Let's play a little clip of get at some of what you were talking about there, Jack. In an interview with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow Wednesday, Parnas claimed that Vice President Pence's attendance at Ukrainian President Zelensky's inauguration was conditioned on Ukraine announcing an investigation into Joe Biden. Parnas told Maddow the Trump team didn't care, as you say, about an actual investigation, just the appearance of one.
President Trump is supposed to go. He decides not to go. Vice President Pence will go instead.
He sends him instead, yeah. And basically, he was supposed to go there and get it straightened out that Zelensky was supposed to make another announcement. And that didn't happen. And that's when Secretary Bolton went over there, and I think he has a lot to say.
Darlene Superville, he's implicated Vice President Pence. Obviously, if they were able to get Pence in front of the Senate, he might have things to say. It's unlikely to happen. John Bolton has said, yeah, I'll go if the Senate asks me to come. So far, that certainly hasn't happened. Mike Pompeo has been enormously quiet. One of the things that's surprising about the Secretary of State's silence is that former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch was said, according to Parnas and according to some text messages from one of Parnas's guys over in Ukraine, an American, a former service member, but who was there, was texting him saying he had Yovanovitch under surveillance while she was serving as ambassador, and that they were going to definitely be part of Parnas's efforts to pressure, giving him information about her as Parnas was trying to pressure the Ukrainians to get rid of her. And the monitoring seemed to have sort of an ominous overtone. Now, Parnas has said he didn't take seriously the idea of any threat to her. And certainly that's been dismissed by allies of the president. But it does seem sort of amazing that you have somebody who was a sitting U.S. ambassador being followed by Americans who were not operating in any official government capacity, but with a desire to pressure her out of government. What do we make of the secretary's silence, and how tenable is that?
That's a good question. The silence by Secretary of State Pompeo has just been mystifying all across Washington. He never really stood up for Ambassador Yovanovitch last year when she was going through what she was going through in the run-up to her eventual dismissal. And that bothered a lot of the career diplomats at the State Department, that the head of the department would not stand up and vouch for the character and integrity of this career ambassador. In her testimony during the impeachment inquiry, she did speak to some of this feeling that she had that she was being threatened and just fearful and intimidated throughout this whole process. And I think some of what we heard from Lev Parnas with respect to this issue shed some new light on that. I don't know how long Secretary Pompeo will be able to maintain his silence on this. The government in Ukraine has opened an investigation
right
into the alleged surveillance of Ms. Yovanovitch, because it could potentially have broken Ukrainian laws as well as international laws. So it's kind of a wait and see, I think, at this point.
I want to take a couple of quick calls now from Madison, Wisconsin. Matt, thank you for listening. Tell us about your thoughts about the impeachment process that's playing out in Capitol Hill.
Well, I'm a Republican, so here's how I view this inquiry. One, I believe the president is allowed to look back at Joe Biden and his son's dealings in Ukraine, which could potentially have been illegal, which is the way I think most Republicans are looking at this, saying that the president legitimately should have been able to say, we want you to take a look at potential illegalities that were going on and with your previous administration to make sure you're above board. So the holding of money back, which the Ukrainians didn't know about, to me would seem that he was doing his due diligence, saying, we need to find out what's going on here. And as far as the ambassador and everybody else that is upset, they serve at the pleasure of the president. If he doesn't want to keep employing them, they're done. And he can do that whether he decides this ambassador is not doing what my administration and my policy as I see it for the future of the United States. So therefore, we're going to dismiss them. And being able to potentially say, is she doing what we're asking her to do? Because she's been here through multiple administrations, mm-hmm. I don't think is out of line.
Can I ask you a quick question, very quick question, Matt? One of your senators, Ron Johnson, is a Republican from Wisconsin, not up for election this year. But say he were to invite in more witnesses, say he were to have qualms about which way he were to vote on that. Would that affect your willingness to support him as a Republican? That is your support as a Republican conditional on the support that that senators might have for the president?
So here's how I see a witness. If they have firsthand direct information, I'm fine with it. If it's all hearsay and, hey, I got fired from my job and I think it was for this reason, or, hey, I heard this from somebody else and so I don't like it because something happened to me because it's third hand, then I would have a very big problem with it. I want to see the same rules that would apply in a court of law for a witness apply to people that are going to testify in front of the Senate.
Thank you so much for that, Matt. Quickly, we're going to take one more call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brendan, thanks for listening.
Yeah, regarding the witnesses, Susan Collins is a fraud. She does this all the time. She always pretends she's going to do the right thing, but then she just ends up towing the party line. And most importantly, can I get your takes on this weekend's football games?
Well, forgive me. I think we're going to allow the jury to remain out on that one just for the sake of time. But thank you for that, Brendan. On Susan Collins, I want to go to one of her colleagues, a clip from Arizona Senator Martha McSally. She was a Republican appointed to serve out the full term of the late Senator John McCain. She called CNN reporter Manu Raju a liberal hack for asking her whether she would vote to include additional witnesses in the Senate impeachment trial. But on Fox News last night, McSally didn't seem any more comfortable answering the question from a conservative who's a supporter of the president, and that's host Laura Ingraham.
What about Manu Raju's question? Do you want witnesses?
Sure. I want a fair trial.
Okay, you're not going to answer. I'm going to play the game with you.
No.
You can call me a conservative hack, but do you want witnesses, yes or no? Why aren't you telling us?
Because we're going to vote on Tuesday to start the trial and let them present the
But how are you going to vote on the motion for more for witnesses?
We're going to get to that. I mean, I'm not going to tell everybody what all my votes are going to be. But obviously, my point—
Pretty easy question, don't you think, Senator?
I think we're going to proceed forward at that point, and I really—
But you're not going to vote with Romney and the others,
all down.
Are you? You're going to vote—
I think we'll proceed to a final vote, I hope, with strong unity after phase one is complete.
Okay.
Jack Beatty— It seems to me as though there are a number of senators in the Republican Party in particular who are vulnerable at this moment and have to be perceived as being fair in a number of states. You think of Tom Tillis in North Carolina. You mentioned Cory Gardner earlier, Martha McSally. This and Susan Collins, which our caller brought up with some sort of tart language there. And yet there are going to be some Democrats too. You think of Sinema in Arizona. That's a real swing state. You think of Joe Manchin in the conservative state of West Virginia. How is this going to affect what senators are willing to do?
I think absolutely. I mean, there is, you know, that is the calculation politicians live by. Can I stand to be reelected? Will this hurt me? And I think we heard from Matt a very sort of, you know, informed and intelligent statement of Republican fealty to the president and the feeling they have, Republicans, that the president is being impeached for things that presidents just do. You know, they can fire ambassadors. They can look into corruption. They can that seems to be accepted, and I get, and the president has made it difficult for his followers in the Senate to accommodate nuance. He's the president says my perfect phone call
with, right,
you know, in the Clinton impeachment, Bill Clinton said I did wrong,
right?
No,
Clinton was his defense was, I'm far from perfect, man. All right, thanks
yes.
for that, Jack. We wanted to also acknowledge to listeners developments this week. 11 U.S. troops, it turned out, were injured in that Iranian missile attack, despite the Pentagon's initial statements there were no casualties. We're also going to look ahead to some of the trade developments, and we'll talk about how tensions between Senator Sanders and Warren bubbled into plain view over questions of electability and of sexism. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. In other news this week, the Russian prime minister and Russian government resigned en masse this week. Critics have speculated about the shift that extends Putin's control beyond the presidency. The flu vaccine administered this year in the U.S. doesn't quite match the strain of the flu infecting most people across the country. Health officials say it's too early to tell how bad this flu season will be, but 27 children have already died this season from it. And a sign-stealing scandal rocked Major League Baseball. The Houston Astros manager and general manager were fired this week for their roles in a cheating scheme during the World Series winning season in 2017 that continued in 2018. Two other managers were also fired. That's a story we're also tracking here at On Point. You can follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. Back with us, a smart panel of guests guiding through this busy week in the news. We have Kimberly Atkins from WBUR, Darlene Superville from the Associated Press, and our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Darlene Superville, let's touch on a moment on this new trade deal. It's being touted by the president and his allies as sort of a counterpoint to impeachment, saying, look at the important and weighty things that we're doing while you people are wasting your time up on Capitol Hill. What has been announced, and what are the merits of this accord?
Well, there are two trade deals that the president can now talk about. There was the China trade deal that he signed on Wednesday, the initial phase or phase one of what he had hoped would be a much bigger, more comprehensive trade deal with China that would, in his mind, bring China to its knees. And then yesterday in the Senate, you had the Senate pass sort of a rewrite of what we know as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which the president has renamed the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement. He talks about both of those in very outsized terms, how good they both will be for American workers and especially American farmers who suffered a great deal under the trade war that President Trump initiated with China about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and the tariff war that went on between both of those countries. The USMCA deal took a year. It was passed. It was agreed to a year ago between the three countries, and then it kind of sat around Congress for a while. Democrats worked on it, worked with the trade representative union groups to get it to a place where their members could vote on it, stronger enforcement, provisions having to do with prescription drugs and pricing and so on. And so that cleared the Senate yesterday. And, you know, the president and the people around him say these are both good for the U.S., good for the economy. They'll create lots of jobs. And all those things, of course, remain to be seen.
Darlene, call me crazy, but it feels as though, you know, NAFTA was, by the accounts of some, including people from the opposing party, Elizabeth Warren, who wants to replace the president, voted for the updated deal that the president's administration got through. It feels as though it's an update. With the Chinese, it feels as though the president is kind of back where he started. In a sense, or you know, in the same position that the George W. Bush and Obama administrations found themselves with, just that ultimately, even if you see a competitor and a, something of a threat in China, you have to find ways to do business with them. Am I completely wrong here?
No, I don't think so. The NAFTA USMCA, that clearly was an update. There was some tinkering and updating of provisions. NAFTA was passed in 1994, so it was 20, 25, 26 years old and probably was due for some sort of updating and tinkering around the edges. In the case of China, you know, one thing you'll hear from the White House is that the United States has never had any kind of agreement like this with China. And China has been a longtime rival of the United States. We've been critical of their trade practices for a long time, but no one has ever seemed to be able to bring the Chinese to the table and have these negotiations and try to pressure China to change its trading practices towards the U.S. There are those that argue, of course, that what the president signed on Wednesday doesn't really do that, and there's going to be a second phase of negotiations with China, which the president calls phase two, that is supposed to get into some more of the thornier issues surrounding China and its trade practices and alleged theft of intellectual property from U.S. manufacturers and corporations and things of that sort that were not in the phase one agreement, because these negotiations had been going on and on and on, and the U.S. was putting on tariffs, then China was countering with more tariffs, and it was getting kind of mutually destructive in a sense. And so they've done phase one, pushed the other things off the table, and now they'll go back and try to work on those other issues, which the president has said he doesn't see a deal, a phase two deal happening before the election.
My NPR colleague, Emily Fang, the Beijing correspondent there, said that in looking at that first deal that was signed, you know, the Chinese, for example, promised to buy an extra $200 billion of American exports, but kind of conditional on if the products were themselves priced highly competitively and if it was meeting their needs. And there was a lot of hedging going on there. It appears to remain to be seen whether or not it leads that way. One of the things that you're kind of indicating, Darlene, it seems to me, is also these were things that were reached after the administration managed to sort of leverage things to a place of crisis. And it is a sort of a mode where it's sort of crisis and return, as in, if you think about Iran, the president now saying after that heightened tensions, confrontation possibly leading to conflict, the president now says he's willing to negotiate with the Iranians again. I want to turn now to the domestic arena, turn to the Kimberly Atkins, to the debates that played out this week among Democrats, what happened on stage, as well as in a moment what happened afterward. Tell us what you saw, Kimberly, in that narrowed Democratic field. I believe six remaining folks making the debate stage, as we are just a couple of weeks from those first caucuses in Iowa. Who seems to have steadied themselves, and how are you seeing the kind of arguments that the candidates are making be clarified as they enter this home stretch?
Well, this debate is the one, the last one. It was the last one before the Iowa caucuses. And overall, on during the debate, before the handshaking took place, it seemed that the strategy was do no harm among all of these candidates. They're trying to solidify the support that they have and not turn anybody off. Because remember, in Iowa, these are caucuses. So second choices matter. Sometimes third choices matter. If a voter voter's first choice gets knocked out, then you go to the second choice. And a lot of people in Iowa haven't made up their minds. They will show up at their caucus sites, still open-minded. So it was very light on attacks. You didn't see the sharp jabs that you've seen in earlier debates. And that's a big reason why the candidates are being careful and just making their cases to the voters themselves. That was, of course, until the end of the debate when Senator Elizabeth Warren was caught on a hot mic saying to Bernie Sanders after their discussion about whether or not Bernie Sanders mentioned in a private conversation that he believed a woman couldn't win. Elizabeth Warren accused him of being a liar, and Bernie Sanders first said he didn't want to talk about it then, but added that he thinks that she called him a liar. And of course, that once that tape was found, that sort of exploded this sort of internal feud that is happening between the two of them, that their campaigns had spent a great deal of time trying to tamp down to us reporters before heading in. Because, again, it doesn't help them heading into Iowa if it appears that these two progressive candidates who could appeal to multiple voters are fighting.
One of our listeners writes in, Karen Worth posts on Twitter, has anyone else decided they'd have a hard time voting for Elizabeth Warren now? The drama seemingly was orchestrated by Warren and by CNN. Sad and shameful, and shows a meanness on Warren's part. Jack Beatty, what do you make of both the tension between the two and of the underlying question? In a sense, it's something I've heard from feminists, in fact, as I've talked to various kinds of people over the course of this Democratic primary, which is, would it be tougher in current America for a woman to be elected as president? Is that a valid concern, or is it just sexist to raise that as a question?
Unfortunately, it is a valid concern. Michelle Cottle in the New York Times this week does a very good job of pulling together research on this question in an editorial called "Are We Ready to Elect a Woman President?" And the answer seems to be perhaps. She points to a study of Yale researchers. They asked people's attitude. Here's a male senator. He's ambitious. What do you think about that? Great. Here's a woman senator. She's ambitious. What do you think about that? Well, quote, that raised feelings of moral outrage, contempt, anger, and disgust for being ambitious. She points to a poll conducted by Lean In September that found that 53% of voters were extremely or very ready for a woman president, but only 16% thought that most Americans felt the same way. And she quotes from Rachel Thomas, the executive of Lean In, which is a women's research group, saying, if voters don't think that America is ready, they tend to be less likely to vote for a woman themselves. Essentially, underlying the whole question. And then Cottle points out, she says, Sanders' alleged remarks struck a nerve. Women candidates and their supporters aren't simply outraged that he could be so wrong. They're worried he might be right.
Darlene Superville, let me quickly ask you two questions about that. One is that in keeping with what you sense as you do reporting in anticipation of this campaign?
I'm sorry?
I was just saying, is that in keeping with what you're hearing from whether it's strategists or whether it's voters as you anticipate, the lead up to this general election?
Yes, but one of the things that came up after the Warren Sanders clash, post-debate clash on Wednesday night, was the reminder that Hillary Clinton got 3 million or so more votes than mm-hmm. Donald Trump in 2016. So what is the hang-up in the United States of America over electing a woman president when so many other countries around the world have already gone there?
Mm-hmm. And that is that they've already shown the majority of Americans that they're happy to vote for a woman. It's just it didn't work out in terms of the electoral calculations
right.
In the Electoral mm-hmm. College. And out of curiosity, the Trump White House, are they eager to face a female candidate? Are they concerned about the ability of somebody like Elizabeth Warren to connect with progressive or progressive voters or voters who feel as though elites have abandoned them in some way.
Yeah, they are, because you will hear the president every now and again, particularly at his rallies, raise Elizabeth Warren's name in the context of the nickname that he's given her. And he'll talk about how he went after her a little bit too early, you know, last year, or maybe it was the year before, when he was seemingly every day just sort of poking her with this nickname. But I do believe the White House and the president is probably more concerned about somebody like Joe Biden. And this morning, the president has sent a number of tweets about Mike Bloomberg. So I think they're a little bit more concerned about those two candidates than they are about Elizabeth Warren at this point.
Okay. I want to move now to some domestic developments in the last few minutes of the show. I want to talk a little bit about efforts by law enforcement officials to crack down on threats. Attorney General William Barr gave an update this week on investigation of the shooting at a naval air station in Pensacola, Florida, earlier this month. The gunman was a member of the Royal Saudi Air Force training at the base. He killed three U.S. sailors. Barr called the shooting an act of terrorism.
During the course of the investigation, we learned that the shooter posted a message on September 11th of this year stating, "The countdown has begun." During the Thanksgiving weekend, he then visited the 9/11 memorial in New York City. He also posted other anti-American, anti-Israeli, and jihadi messages on social media, including 2 hours before his attack.
Meanwhile, Kimberly Atkins, law enforcement officials have announced indictments against members of a group calling themselves The Base, which were white supremacists that they suggested were plotting or thinking about violent acts against blacks and other people of color, if I'm not mistaken. And the governor of Virginia has, in anticipation of this weekend, a protest scheduled by white supremacists, has declared a state of emergency in the state's capital there, as I understand it, because of concerns about what may break out. What do we know about those, either of those instances, in terms of the ability of authorities to address concerns about that in ways that might be more constructive than what played out, say, for example, in Charlottesville a couple of years ago?
Well, that's the concern, right? After Charlottesville and after, according to FBI data, there has been an increase in hate-related violence and hate-related activities in recent years. I think what you're seeing are Virginia officials, to the best of their ability, trying to get ahead of this. And there has been a lot of criticism about the FBI's failure to address that threat in particular. There had been a lot of focus on anti-terror from foreign threats, but not as much about domestic terror threats. And so it appears, at least in this case, if this is the case, given these arrests, perhaps that this is good news, that law enforcement got ahead and made these arrests before something awful could happen this weekend. But that's something that federal and state authorities are continuing to try to address, and clearly a problem that is far from being eradicated.
We're hearing there the voice of Kimberly Atkins. She's a senior news correspondent at WBUR. Kimberly, thank you for sharing your reporting and analysis with us this week.
Thanks for having me.
And we've also been hearing from Darlene Supervoll. She covers the White House for the Associated Press. We so much appreciate your time, Darlene.
You're welcome.
And thanks, too, to our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Thanks a lot, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can always follow us on the Twitters, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And now I'd like to take a brief moment to a word about Karen Schiffman. She's our executive producer. She's been with the show since its inception in 2001 and has been a pillar of its success and relevance to listeners throughout the country ever since. I want to thank her for welcoming this hosting newbie back in 2018. Wonderful news junkie. We appreciate all you've done. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.